same attention to detail that had helped to decide on the location in the first place. Even as Kodos and the majority of his followers proceeded into the mountains toward their camp, the vehicles were returned to the city and their drivers remained there, doing their best to verify that the escape was made without detection. As for their choice of refuge, there were other areas within this region that afforded easier access, but they lacked the higher concentrations of minerals and other subterranean geomagnetic activity that thwarted sensor technology of the sort the Starfleet ship would be employing. Indeed, the levels of interference here were so pervasive that he was able to emerge without worry from their hiding place, stealing a few moments for himself each day to greet the dawn. If his hunters wanted him, they would have to work for it.
"What can I do for you, Ian?" he asked.
Galloway stepped closer. "You wanted to be informed if we received any word from our friends in the city. There's been a development. One of our people has been taken into custody."
"That was to be expected. Perhaps it was inevitable."
"Yes, Governor, but the person they've captured is Alexander Simmons." It took Kodos an extra few seconds to process the report. Shifting his seat on the rock serving as his perch, he eyed his assistant.
"You're certain?"
"The information comes from our contact at Security Forces headquarters. They saw him brought in after being apprehended by two Starfleet officers."
"How is this even possible?"
Kodos stopped himself, remembering that Galloway did not know the truth about his plans for Simmons on the night of the sacrifice. It was a bit of information restricted to himself, Joel Pekaski, and the man sent to carry out his order, Marcus Seidel. Himself a security officer, Seidel was given specific instructions with respect to Simmons, but in his rush to move to a temporary hiding place while planning his escape from New Anchorage, Kodos had somehow overlooked obtaining a final determination regarding Simmons, or Seidel, for that matter. Neither man arrived to join the group leaving the city, and Kodos realized his oversight. He should have had Pekaski look into the matter, both to ascertain Seidel's whereabouts and to verify that Simmons was dead. According to our contact at security headquarters, Simmons was able to escape being killed by Officer Seidel. Galloway's matter-of-fact statement caught Kodos by surprise. He regarded his assistant with new appreciation of his apparent resourcefulness, but also a small amount of apprehension.
"How do you know this?"
"Simmons recounted his version of the story to his interrogators. Seidel attempted to kill him, but Simmons turned the tables and escaped the amphitheater. He then laid low at his girlfriend's apartment until he was found by the Starfleet search party." Galloway paused, his expression turning thoughtful. "He was originally supposed to be part of our group, was he not?" A gust of wind coursed through the valley and up to the plateau, chilling Kodos to the point that he pulled his collar tighter around his neck as he considered how best to respond to his assistant. Deciding truth was his best option, he said,
"Simmons was not a believer. He doubted that what we were doing was just. That much is reasonable, as what I was suggesting would be overwhelming for anyone. However, I was concerned that he would falter at the moment of truth, when we most needed him to set aside his personal feelings and act for the greater good. So I sent Seidel to make sure Simmons carried out his duty, or, failing that, to make sure he couldn't compromise us."
"I understand, Governor," said Galloway. "This is what Simmons communicated to his captors. For whatever my opinion's worth, I think you made the right decision. Anyone holding such doubts puts us all at risk." Kodos was surprised to hear such conviction from his assistant. Why had he not perceived such feelings from Galloway before now? Was he so consumed with everything that had transpired over the past several days that such subtle clues escaped him? Perhaps there were other details that had evaded his attention. That could be dangerous, given his current surroundings. Did he trust everyone around him? There was Galloway and Joel Pekaski, both of whom had more than proven their loyalty, but what of the other 20 people hiding with him? Before all of this, he would never have needed to question their devotion, either to him or the cause into which they all had entered. How many of them were driven more by personal survival than any other consideration? Under any other circumstances, it would be a reasonable stance to take, but none of those involved him. On the other hand, the desire to survive and, in this case, avoid arrest and criminal prosecution would provide powerful motivation to work together in pursuit of this mutual goal. It was only when the situation began to deteriorate that the true character of those he had chosen to help him would be revealed.
Here's hoping it doesn't come to that. What else did Simmons tell the authorities?
Galloway replied, "The Starfleet response team is engaged in a major search effort. They're sweeping the city looking for us. A few of our people have been rounded up, but Simmons was their most significant capture. It's a safe bet they'll use him to expand their search." He paused, and Kodos saw the younger man was nervous. One of the officers who found Simmons was the commander of the outpost garrison. According to the report I received, this man seems particularly driven to find us.
To find me, you mean?
Not for the first time, Kodos shook his head as he contemplated the folly of sending a team to raid the Starfleet observation outpost. It seemed a prudent move, given that the five-person detail possessed weapons and other equipment that might prove useful to resisting the security forces if circumstances called for that sort of action. The outpost also had its own food supply, which, according to the facility's ranking officer, had escaped infection by the rampant fungus. The officer, a man named Lorca, even offered their uncontaminated food stores to be added to the colony's remaining supplies. It was a show of solidarity welcomed by Governor Ribeiro and the Leadership Council, and appreciated even by Kodos. However, Lorca and his team were liabilities to be dispatched, lest they become legitimate problems for Kodos and the Revolution. "The teams we sent to the outpost killed two of the Starfleet officers," said Galloway. "Therefore, this Commander Lorca almost certainly knows you ordered that action. According to our contact, he was rather animated during his questioning of Simmons. It stands to reason he has a personal interest in finding us." Kodos realized that he had underestimated the abilities of the Starfleet personnel, who he assumed were technicians rather than trained security specialists. It was a mistake that was coming back to haunt him. Lorca, in particular, seemed to possess some tactical training and experience. Would he seek justice for the death of his colleagues? Perhaps. What if he was motivated by other factors? Like so many others impacted by the sacrifice, he may have had personal relationships with one or more of the civilian colonists. Vengeance could be a powerful motivator, and now it seemed this Lorca had access to pertinent information to assist his search.
"He'll use Simmons," said Kodos. "He'll use him to find us."
Turning from Galloway, he took in the grand vista before him. With the sun now above the horizon, the mountain valley was cast in an ethereal glow that soothed him. It was utter serenity, a scene in which he could lose himself forever.
"Such is not to be. We can't stay here. Sooner or later, the search will be brought to our doorstep. They'll find us. We need to plan for that eventuality."
Galloway said, "If we leave, won't they be able to track our movements?"
"Ultimately, yes."
Kodos knew he and his followers possessed the advantage. The terrain was their ally, but the Starfleet forces would soon overcome that obstacle. What he needed was a diversionary action, some sort of distraction that might provide the cover necessary to go... where? Back to the city? Was the answer to double back on his pursuers, somehow finding a way past the security cordons in order to lose himself within New Anchorage? It was a ploy worth considering, but it would take planning and no small amount of luck to achieve success. They could not wait. Time was running short. 25. Lorca saw the man ahead of him stumble, his right foot slipping on a slick section of flat rock outcropping. His leg went out from under him, and the man pitched backward, the weight of his pack pulling him off balance and casting him toward the sloping ground. Others in proximity shouted various warnings as he started to tumble. His arms were flailing in an attempt at catching on to anything to keep from rolling down the hill. Stepping to his left to avoid getting swept away, Lorca extended his right arm and seized one of the man's hands in his own. The speed and extra weight almost managed to drag him down, but Lorca was able to set his feet and lean against the abrupt pull on his arm. Within seconds, the man's fall was arrested and he was lying on his back, wincing in momentary pain from the unexpected shock. "You okay?" asked Lorca, shaking his right arm to throw off the minor discomfort of nearly having it yanked from its socket. The other man, a civilian whose name Lorca could not remember, nodded,
"Yeah, thanks for that. I didn't see the moss on that rock."
Lorca gestured to the soles of the man's shoes.
"That's not the best footwear for being out here."
The tread was decent enough for streets and sidewalks, but lacking for uneven or wet terrain such as what the group was traversing.
"You'll need to watch your step. Don't want to be getting a twisted ankle or a broken leg."
He offered a small grin to remove some of the sting from his rebuke.
"It's a long way back to base camp, and I really don't want to carry you."
"I've actually got a pair of boots in my pack. I just didn't think I'd need them until we got a bit higher up in the mountains. I guess we both know how that's worked out. I'll be careful, Commander. Thanks."
Offering his hand, Lorca braced himself as he pulled the other man to his feet.
"What's your name?" he asked.
"Denham. Brian Denham."
The name rang a bell, and Lorca recalled seeing it on the list of civilians who had been vetted as having no known ties to Kodos. While screening personnel for the team that would help with the search for the fugitive governor, preference was given to those with military, law enforcement, or outdoors experience. However, the need to avoid bringing in possible Kodos sympathizers forced Lorca to consider alternative candidates. Despite lacking certain desired skills, people like Denham were eager to help in any feasible manner.
"What do you do, Brian?"
Straightening the straps of his pack and resettling it on his back, Denham replied,
"I'm a computer specialist. My wife is a molecular biologist."
"Ever been hiking or camping?"
The other man's face reddened.
"That's obvious, huh?"
"A bit, yeah."
In addition to the man's ill-suited footwear, his outer garments were not sturdy enough for the unrefined outdoors. His jacket, some kind of lightweight polymer, was torn thanks to his accident, and his backpack appeared stuffed to overflowing, likely with items that would serve little to no practical purpose out here. In contrast, Lorca carried a standard-issue Starfleet field pack on his back, containing only those items he knew from experience would be of practical value in this environment. He had added a sheathed hunting knife to his equipment belt, and his pack was fitted with a compartment that held drinking water, complete with a tube he could access without removing his gear from his back. Its side pockets held field rations and extra power cells for his phaser. Suitable clothing to handle the various elements rested in the pack's main compartment. Anything else the pack contained would be categorized by Lorca as luxury items.
"Stay warm, stay hydrated, and stay ready to fight," his combat and wilderness survival instructors told him over and over during training that felt as though it had occurred a lifetime ago. "The rest of it will sort itself out later." "What made you volunteer for this, Brian?"
Denham's expression turned somber.
"My father was in the amphitheater that night. I want to help find the man who did that to him and all the others."
"Your father?"
Lorca estimated Denham to be in his mid to late 40s, meaning his father would likely have been 25 to 30 years older. Kodos had included a number of elderly colonists in his sacrifice action, and the very thought once again set his teeth on edge. In a cold, calculating sense, the governor's actions could be seen as motivated by a certain practicality, but it did not lessen Lorca's desire to pummel the man with his bare hands.
"Heartless prick."
"I was born on Epsilon Serona," said Denham. "My parents were among the original settlers on that planet, and we were all brought here as part of the relocation."
He paused, looking around the magnificent vista surrounding them.
"This is our home. And I want to help find the bastard who took my father away from me, and all the other mothers and fathers he took from everyone else."
Whatever he might think of the man's outdoor skills, Lorca could admire Denim's convictions. After all, there was a risk to what they were doing here, including a good chance that Kodos, if found and realizing he had nothing to lose, might decide to stage a last stand. Assuming that happened, there could be injuries or worse. Denim, like the other civilian volunteers, was not carrying a phaser, as there were not enough of them to cover every member of the search party. The man had a knife on his belt along with a hatchet, and what Lorca recognized as a cricket bat sticking out of the top of his backpack. Lorca was not sure how effective such improvised weapons might be should a firefight break out, but he had to concede that the idea of employing the bat held some appeal.
Steady, Commander. Thanks for joining us, Brian. I appreciate it. You might want to think about switching to those boots before too long.
Denim smiled.
Sure thing.
Allowing the other man to move up the mountain path to rejoin his group of fellow volunteers, Lorca waited for Ensign Terry Bridges to catch up to him. Walking beside her and carrying a field pack similar to hers was Alexander Simmons.
"How's our guide?" asked Lorca. "Giving you any trouble?"
Bridges threw a sidelong glance toward Simmons.
"Are you giving me trouble?"
"You threatened to throw me off a mountain if I did."
Grinning, Bridges looked to Lorca.
"See? No trouble."
Lorca stifled the urge to laugh.
"How are you holding up?"
"Well, I haven't hiked like this since Academy survival training, but I'll be okay. I think I should add something like this into my exercise routine, though."
"Maybe we can revise the training schedule once we're all back to our regular duties."
Lorca turned his attention to Simmons.
"Anything around here look familiar to you?"
The other man scowled.
"It's a mountain. It looks a lot like the other ones. You understand I'm okay with Bridges throwing you off this one, right?"
When Simmons made the wise choice not to reply, Lorca added,
"You're here to help us home in on Kodos's location. If you can't do that, then I'll give you the push you need to roll your worthless ass back down to base camp. Do we understand each other?"
Simmons nodded.
"We do."
The disgraced security officer had said little since the search party left behind the ground vehicles that could no longer traverse the rugged, angled terrain. The vehicles formed a perimeter around the small base camp established as a support station for Lorca and the group of 25 people who were continuing the hunt on foot. The search party was one of four distributed throughout the mountain region, each converging on the center of the area from a different direction while using whatever trail or other means available to maneuver over the unforgiving ground.
"Unforgiving in more ways than one."
Lorca and the others knew going in that the natural geomagnetic activity taking place far beneath the surface would interfere with sensors and all but cancel out the ability to use transporters to beam anyone or anything to or from the region. Communications and even personal tricorders were other casualties of the situation, as Lorca quickly discovered once they were well away from the base camp and into the first of the mountain valleys assigned to his group's search grid. Tricorder scans of the area were inundated with the background interference, inhibiting their usefulness for anything beyond 20 to 30 meters. Communicators operated in similar fashion, unable to establish a reliable signal much beyond 100 meters. Anticipating this twist, Lorca had taken the precaution of preparing printed topographical surface maps of the region, generated from the Narbonne's sensor scans of the entire mountain range. The maps would serve them only on the surface, but they, along with special compasses developed for use even in areas of the planet where the geomagnetic interference was strongest, would at least provide a sense of direction and distance traveled. He took it a step further by having Simmons mark on the maps where he believed Kodos and his followers had hiding places or caches of equipment and even possible escape routes. Simmons was lacking when it came to information in that department, and some of his selections on the map made Lorca suspicious, but comparing his marks to sensor data of the region had given him no reason to either accept or deny the security officer's insights. Given that reality, Lorca reminded himself of what he told Giorgio about this entire plan.
"There's only one way to find out if it'll work."
He could adapt to the lack of tricorders, sensors, or transporters, but the inability to summon reinforcements either from the camp or the Narbonne crew was more than a little concerning. They would just have to adapt and rely on the tried and trusted method of sweep-and-clear search missions, the way he conducted them as a junior ensign undertaking reconnaissance forces operations, and later during Starfleet security training. As his instructors took great glee in reminding him, technology was never a substitute for boots on the ground. Lorca fell into step beside Simmons, taking the opportunity to scan the column of men and women working their way up the hill behind and ahead of him. The route they were traversing was not so much an established path as it was simply a natural groove cut into the rolling hillside, likely the result of water runoff over the course of millennia. At his instructions, the column proceeded through the valley and into the foothills while maintaining intervals of 4 to 5 meters between individuals. It was a habit from his ground forces days that Lorca had never shaken, and being in here, in this place, under load and carrying a weapon while hunting an enemy, had brought long-dormant skills and experience to the fore. At the head of the loose formation was Lieutenant Jason Giler, who, along with a dozen members of the Narbonne's security detachment, accounted for half of the search team. 4 members of his detail were spread to either side of the column, acting as sweepers to ensure no one approached the group from their flanks. The rest of the party was comprised of civilians like Brian Denham, who were doing their best to compensate for their lack of field skills with an eagerness to contribute to the cause. However, a couple of the people Lorca chose to join the search did possess at least some outdoors experience, along with a rough familiarity with this region. This he welcomed, as relying on Alexander Simmons for all of his on-site intel was not a sound tactical plan. Lorca was still expecting the security officer to pull some kind of play, either to escape or to warn Kodos or anyone else who might be nearby that danger was approaching. His gut told him Simmons would not betray them so much as act in his own self-interest, but that would be enough for Lorca to make good on his threat. "We'll see. Are there any landmarks we should be looking for?" he asked, glancing toward Simmons. "Subtle clues left for anyone coming to join Kodos and the others?" Even knowing what to look for with respect to detecting passage through an area, Lorca had seen nothing to indicate the presence of anyone who had no reason to be here. No footprints, dislodged rocks, or flattened vegetation, and no trash or other evidence of sentient yet sloppy beings on the move. Experience told him this was conclusive of nothing, either because Kodos and his people knew how to conceal their movements, or else they had taken a different path through the region. Assuming they came through here at all. A flash of light and a muffled explosion from somewhere ahead of them made Lorca flinch, and he looked up the hill to see a body being thrown off his or her feet several meters through the air before landing with a heavy thud on the hillside. A cloud of dirt shrouded the figure as it rolled a few extra meters along the ground before coming to rest against a rock outcropping. Hearing the shouts of alarm from other members of the search party and without thinking, Lorca grabbed Simmons with his left hand and dropped to one knee, dragging the other man with him. His other hand had drawn the phaser from its holster on his waist, and he brought up the weapon, glancing at its power level and confirming it was set to stun. From the corner of his eye, he saw Ensign Bridges mimicking his movements. Around them, he noted how other members of the team were crouching or lying on the ground, weapons up and assuming defensive positions as everyone scanned for other threats. No one spoke, and Lorca listened and looked for telltale signs of an approaching attack, but heard nothing. "Dear God," said Bridges, keeping her voice low. "Was that Giler?" Lorca was already attempting to determine who the casualty might be, and it took little time to figure out, based on where the explosive detonated, that it had to be Giler. The security detachment commander was leading them all up the hill, and would be the likely victim of any sort of booby trap? "I don't believe this." Instructing Bridges to remain with Simmons, Lorca rose to a low crouch and began moving up the hill toward the fallen figure. As he passed other members of the search party, he gestured for them to maintain their positions. His eyes darted about the ground ahead of him, searching for anything that appeared out of place or otherwise did not belong. He saw nothing, and yet every rock or clump of grass was a potential danger. It took him the better part of a minute to reach what he saw was the unmoving form of Jason Giler. The lieutenant had landed on his back, his torso elevated by the field pack beneath him. Blood ran from several wounds on his face, and a significant portion of his torso, including his uniform jacket, was blackened. Kneeling next to him, Lorca pressed the first two fingers on his left hand against the side of the other man's neck, searching for a pulse. He found none.
Damn it!
Phaser held before him in both hands, Lorca swept the weapon from side to side, but saw no signs of anyone else ahead of him along the hillside. His eyes did fall on a section of ground just beneath a large hunk of rock protruding from the soil. Damp, dark soil, along with bits of stone, littered the ground leading to the hole, scattered in an undeniable blast pattern. A proximity trigger. It was the one thing that made the most sense, given the visual evidence. Lorca was familiar with the devices, having received training long ago on their use in tactical situations. In those cases, they were employed as defensive measures, such as aiding to secure a perimeter in anticipation of an attack. Even then, they were meant as deterrents, used to activate sensory disruption devices by releasing bursts of intense light or sound. The use of proximity triggers to activate anti-personnel explosives had been outlawed by the Federation and Starfleet for nearly a century.
Commander?
Glancing over his shoulder, Lorca saw Ensign Bridges working her way toward him, prodding a very reluctant Simmons to walk ahead of her. When her eyes fell on Giler's stricken form, her eyes widened as the color drained from her face.
Oh, no,
was all the ensign could muster before averting her gaze. Lorca stepped toward Simmons.
What the hell is this?
He grabbed Simmons by the strap of his backpack and pulled, flinging him toward the ground, where he landed on his hands and knees next to Giler.
Goddamned booby traps!
I don't know anything about it,
pleaded Simmons, holding up his empty hands.
I swear I don't know why they'd do something like this!
To slow down anybody trying to track them, said Bridges. Or maybe it's a signal, and now they know we're here.
Lorca said, they likely wouldn't bother with something like this if they weren't protecting something. Either their camp, or a supply or escape route. It could be part of a security perimeter. For all we know, we've wandered into their damned backyard.
He turned to Simmons.
Care to comment?
I think we may be close.
The other man all but stammered his reply.
Uh-huh.
Behind Bridges, other members of the search party were clambering up the hillside, their expressions all displaying varying degrees of shock and horror as they got their first look at Giler. Lorca waved to one of the Starfleet officers, Lieutenant Reese O'Bannon, whom he knew only as Giler's Assistant Security Detachment Commander. As he stepped closer and saw the body of his friend, O'Bannon's face clouded with sorrow and anger.
I'm sorry, Lieutenant. He was killed instantly.
O'Bannon nodded.
Thank you, Commander.
He paused, looking around as though taking stock of the rest of the search party and their surroundings.
There may be more of those things, sir. What do you want us to do?
First, secure Lieutenant Giler.
Lorca checked the chronometer he wore strapped to his left wrist.
It'll be dark soon, so we'll make camp here for the night. I hate to leave Giler here once we move out again in the morning.
I've already done the math, sir,
O'Bannon replied.
Two of my men can take him to base camp and be back here well before sunup.
He glanced once more to Giler.
I won't have any trouble finding a couple of volunteers.
Uncomfortable with that idea, Lorca said,
I'd rather no one walk around here after dark, at least not beyond any area we clear of other surprises.
He could not help glancing to Giler as he spoke.
We'll organize a sweep party with tricorders to scan the immediate area and secure it for the night, and disable any other devices we might find. In the morning, your volunteers can take the lieutenant back to base camp. When the rest of us head out tomorrow, anyone leading the column will be scanning the ground ahead for possible threats.
Once more, he regarded Giler's unmoving form, and this time, he felt anger rising within him.
We're not losing anyone else to those damned things.
Finding a volunteer to walk point might be harder, sir,
said Bridges, before turning her attention to Simmons.
But I do have a suggestion.
That's a mighty fine idea, Ensign. Lorca smiled at the security officer, who appeared none too happy about the conversation's new direction.
"Don't I get a say in this?" asked Simmons.
Fear laced his every word. Forcing himself not to give voice to his barely restrained annoyance with the man and any companions of his who might be lurking nearby, Lorca gestured to Giler.
"Talk it over with him."
Inamori Jen was tired, and the easiest way to demonstrate her mounting fatigue was to release a long, loud yawn.
"That's pretty good," said Asul Sultani, keeping pace beside her as the two of them walked the service corridor of the power distribution station.
Jen eyed him.
"What is?"
"I thought you were imitating the mating call of the Cremorian Fangor beast. It's a worthy impression."
Unable to stifle a laugh, Jen shook her head.
"No, that's not what I was doing. And how do you know what such an animal sounds like, anyway?"
Though she knew of the Cremorian system, she had never visited the lush jungles of the second planet where the fabled predators thrived.
"We undertook survival training there during my third year at the academy," replied Sultani. "They warned us about them several times during our pre-mission briefings, but nothing prepares you for seeing one up close."
He grimaced.
"Nothing."
"You saw one? Up close?"
The computer specialist nodded.
"Pretty close. Until I started running, that is. Thankfully, they don't like the water. So I swam a lot that day."
Laughing again, Jen offered him a mock scowl.
"Now you're joking with me."
"Would I lie to you? Check the Academy's archived historical documents. Our training mission reports are all there."
For the briefest of moments, Jen wondered if Sultani might be having a bit of fun at her expense. She considered breaking her personal rule of not reading the thoughts of co-workers and other colleagues. Doing so would be simple enough, but was also a betrayal of trust, so far as she was concerned. There were many Betazoids who harbored no compunction about such things, and in truth, it would be far easier for Jen to do so instead of blocking out the minds of those around her. On her homeworld of Beta Zed, the ethics of such choices were left to the individual to determine for themselves. Still, in a society where almost everyone could know everyone else's innermost thoughts and feelings, anything less than total honesty seemed a waste of time, and Beta Zoid civilization evolved over generations to embrace the tenets of openness and transparency. This was fine so long as Betazoids remained isolated unto themselves. Such views could not last once it was learned that other planets harbored their own advanced societies and interaction with them became inevitable. The first challenge to Betazoid cultural mores came less than a decade ago when scientists successfully launched a ship capable of traveling faster than light and discovered eyes from worlds not their own were watching. Jen had only just reached adolescence when the Starfleet ship settled into orbit around Beta Zed, and government leaders were visited by travelers from a distant star system. No, not just a single star, as the vessel brought with it representatives of several civilizations. Faced with an unprecedented decision, the planet's various government representatives met in secret, making the determination that keeping their psionic abilities a private matter was the best course, at least until more could be learned about their new interstellar acquaintances. The issue arose once more after Beta Zed joined the Federation, and Jen was among the first Betazoids to attend Starfleet Academy. Once more, it was decided to keep this information from non-Betazoids, but even government leaders knew that should their world apply for full Federation membership, they would no longer be able to maintain their secret. For now, though, she was content to abide by her people's wishes.
"Are you all right?" asked Sultani, and Jen realized she had allowed her mind to wander.
"I'm fine."
Another yawn was threatening to escape and echo within the passageway, and she covered her mouth. Their inspection of the distribution station at Commander Georgiou's request was the cap on what already had been a very long day. Indeed,
The 14 hours she had worked today was but the latest in what was threatening to become a string of long days. Jen comprehended the need to pitch in where needed and the priority of making sure all of the city's utility services were online and functioning, but that did nothing for her mounting fatigue.
"We're almost finished," said Sultani, and she heard the sympathy and understanding in his voice.
"Another hour at most, and we're out of here."
Jen replied, "On the other hand, I'm not really looking forward to sleeping on that shelf aboard the ship."
She had to think for a moment to recall when she last slept in a decent bed. The berthing compartment provided for her aboard the Narbonne lacked much when compared to her quarters on Starbase 11. Footsteps echoed from the corridor ahead of them, announcing the arrival of Vanessa Chandra, the power plant's operations manager.
"Good evening," she said, smiling upon seeing the two Starfleet officers. "I was sure you'd have finished and made your escape from this dungeon."
Returning the greeting, Jen said,
"We're almost finished. Even though the interruptions you experienced weren't that extensive, Commander Georgiou insisted we give the entire place one last once-over before finalizing our inspection. So we're doing another walkthrough and then calling it a night."
Chandra's smile widened.
"Have to keep the bosses happy, right?"
Jen recalled from her review of the manager's personnel record that she was a native of Tarsus IV, born soon after her parents' arrival 34 years earlier. Despite her heritage, traces of an accent were still detectable, at least to Jen's ears, hinting at her family roots somewhere in the Indian subcontinent region on Earth. Chandra was dressed in a set of gray coveralls with her access credentials pinned to her collar. This, along with her black hair pulled back from her face and secured in a tight bun, made Chandra look every bit the hard-working, dedicated engineer thrust unwillingly into a leadership position. Jen knew this to be true, as the other woman had made a point of announcing that to anyone who might be within earshot at any given moment. Despite her recent promotion to the manager's billet, Chandra insisted on maintaining a hands-on approach to the plant's operation. If that meant crawling through a service conduit to repair a piece of equipment at the expense of finalizing a status report to her supervisors, then so be it. Jen had taken an instant liking to her.
Sultani asked, "Anything we should know about before we wrap up for the night?"
Shaking her head, Chandra replied, "Not a thing. I've just come from the control room and all the status lights are green. I was about to do my own last rounds before turning it over to the second shift supervisor. You can tag along with me if you like."
The trio set off, heading deeper into the distribution center's maze of corridors, catwalks, service crawlways, and access conduits. Despite all of the machinery and support equipment contained within this three-story structure, noise suppression materials saw to it that any potentially harmful sounds were shielded. This allowed the plant's crew to move about the facility without the need for hearing protection, except for those areas where coming into proximity with the equipment was unavoidable.
"Most of the damage we sustained was confined to outside the building," said Chandra as they walked, passing a pair of engineers working in front of an open access panel that looked stuffed with all manner of computer and electrical circuitry and other components. Both technicians, a man and a woman, nodded at their approach and offered polite greetings.
Sultani said, "The report indicated the damage wasn't all that extensive."
"A couple of distribution conduits and some protective shielding, but nothing too serious," replied Chandra. "Taking the plant offline was more a safety consideration while my people finished the repairs than anything else. Besides, it gave us a chance to test our disaster recovery and backup procedures. Most people in the city didn't even notice anything, as the other two plants were able to shoulder the load."
She paused, and Jen saw her expression change. It was a look she had seen many times since all of this began, and once more she sensed a surge of emotions as Chandra recalled unpleasant memories. Despite this, Jen resisted the urge to take in the other woman's thoughts. The feelings alone were sufficient to communicate the grief being confronted. She had lost someone to Kodos and his executioners, and the level of emotional intensity was enough to tell Jen that it was someone close. As though realizing her change in demeanor was being noticed, Chandra cleared her throat and redirected her attention back to Jen and Sultani.
"I'm sorry. It's just that..."
She let the sentence fade on her lips.
It's all right, said Sultani, laying a hand on her forearm. We understand.
I'm sure you've heard similar stories since you got here.
It was a noble attempt to erect a brave front, though Jen saw through the ruse.
But we haven't heard it from you, she said.
Reaching up to wipe a tear from the corner of her right eye, Chandra offered a small laugh that Jen knew was forced.
We'd only been seeing each other for a couple of months. I met her at one of the bars in the arts district, and we just sort of hit it off. She'd had a bad breakup and didn't want to stay on Tarsus IV anymore. There was a bag packed and lying at her feet in the bar when we met. Anything that didn't fit, she was happy to leave behind.
Chandra's wide brown eyes were watering as she recalled the memory.
I'd been out of a bad relationship for about 6 months, so I knew where she was coming from. We talked all night, and she decided to stay. I didn't even see her for a week after that. And then one day she's standing at my front door.
Once more the smile returned.
I was happier than I'd been in a long time. And so was she. We were already talking long-term plans, and then...
She waved a hand in the air in front of her face.
Then all this happened. Feelings of catharsis and even relief washed over Jen as Chandra spoke.
It was apparent that the mourning woman had spoken with no one about her personal tragedy and had been looking for an outlet. She needed to give voice to her grief and finally was finding some sense of inner peace. After a moment, Chandra wiped her eyes and her expression softened.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to burden you with all of that. It's fine, replied Jen. Really?
A beeping tone echoed in the passageway, making Chandra turn toward a communications panel set into the nearby wall. A red indicator was flashing, and the panel's speaker grill erupted with a loud, anxious male voice that Jen recognized.
Attention, all personnel! This is Supervisor Maharaj. We have an unauthorized entry. First level, west entrance. Emergency lockdown protocols are in effect. Secure your stations and report to central control.
Confusion and concern darkening her features, Chandra looked to Jen and Sultani.
What the hell?
Reaching for the comm panel, she slapped its activation control.
Chandra to control room. Ravi, what's going on?
Over the open channel, the distribution plant's second shift supervisor, Ravi Shankar Maharaj, replied,
We're still figuring it out, Vanessa. The west entrance access lock is offline. And internal scans show that door was opened from the outside. Then everything on the main board went dark. I don't have any of the sensors or...
The rest of Maharaj's report was lost in a burst of static, followed by a low hum coming from the comm panel's speaker.
Ravi?
Chandra tapped the panel's control pad again.
Ravi, are you there?
Looking back to Jen and Sultani, she said,
It's dead.
Jen, drawing her phaser from its holster on her belt, motioned to Chandra. If there are intruders, we can't stay here. Sultani's memories of losing Pyotr and Mijen came rushing back, threatening to pummel her. There's no way to know what they want or what they'll do to get it.
There's a stairwell at the end of this corridor, said Sultani, holding his phaser in both hands. We can use it to get to the control room.
They made it halfway to the stairs before Jen reached for Sultani's arm, halting their advance.
Wait,
she warned, her voice just above a whisper. Sultani looked around, sweeping the passageway in both directions.
What is it? On the stairs. Someone's coming.
Turning to aim his weapon toward the stairwell, Sultani said,
I don't hear anything.
Neither do I,
added Chandra. Jen had not heard anything either. Instead, she had picked up the two sets of thoughts growing closer with every passing second. It had taken little effort to detect the pair of individuals, both males. One of the men was worried about making noise on the stairs while keeping from slipping. Unable to explain any of this, Jen instead motioned her companions to back away from the stairwell before advancing on the doorway, phaser up and ready. The first man appeared at the threshold leading to the stairs. Dressed in dark clothes and a mask covering his face, he made a perfect target. Jen saw his eyes widen in surprise as she fired, the single stun beam catching him in the chest.
He was still falling back into the stairwell when Jen stepped forward, seeing the man's friend reacting to the sudden attack. She pressed the phaser's firing stud again, and the other man crumpled.
Ina!
Jen whirled at Sultani's shout of warning to see the lieutenant and Chandra crouching against the wall of the passageway. Sultani was firing his own weapon at another pair of figures near the corridor's far end. The new arrivals were responding to the threats in their midst, but Sultani was faster, taking both intruders in seconds.
Never mind, he said, tossing a sheepish grin toward Jen.
Want to bet there are more of them?
She asked.
Chandra said, They may be heading for the control room. We have to get up there, or at least warn somebody.
Yes. Jen reached for her communicator. We definitely need to warn somebody. She had no idea if anyone on the Narbonne was monitoring critical facilities like the power distribution plants and watching for any deviations from their normal operation. Maybe the intruders were able to mask their infiltration. If that was the case, then she, along with Sultani, Chandra and everyone else in this building might well be cut off from help. She flipped open her communicator.
Jen, to Commander Georgiou.
Nothing. Not even static.
This can't be good.
Her initial feeling was only strengthened when the lights went out, and she heard the telltale sound of equipment shutting down. Everything seemed to be going offline. Right now.
27. Are we ready?
Cradling in his left elbow the phaser rifle he had taken from one of the new Anchorage Security Forces armories, Joel Pekaski stood behind his computer specialist, Hisayo Fujimura, watching as the young woman's hands moved over the workstation's array of multicolored buttons and switches. He noted that the other three members of his team, all of them dressed like him and Fujimura in black jumpsuits, were positioned at each of the doors leading from the power distribution plant's entrances, making sure no one would disturb them during these next critical minutes.
Almost there, just a few more minutes,
replied Fujimura without looking up from her work. Pekaski tried not to look at either of the room's two wall chronometers or even the smaller model strapped to his wrist. It would not help to stare at their numbers as they advanced with agonizing slowness while he and the others waited for Fujimura to complete her infiltration of the plant's computer system. With nothing to do, he looked to the three unconscious technicians in their midst. One lay on the floor where she had fallen after being stunned, and her two male companions were slumped in the chairs at their respective workstations. Studying the three insensate plant employees, Pekaski was satisfied with his decision not to kill them. There had been enough death in the last handful of days, and he would be glad to be liberated from it. That freedom was in his grasp, perhaps less than an hour away, if all went according to plan.
I'm in, reported Fujimura. I've accessed the system's security protocols, starting my bypass.
The thin, petite Asian was all business, her attention moving between the control console and the portable computer interface she brought with her just for this task. After uncounted hours spread across the past 3 days, foregoing decent sleep and taking her meals at a field desk in the underground hideaway far beneath Mount Bonestell, her efforts were about to pay off in a major fashion. She had already circumvented the plant's internal security sensors, having accomplished that by plugging into a data terminal in the first office they found upon entering the building. The bypass was easy enough to mask, at least long enough for Pekaski to lead his team to the plant's main control room and incapacitate the employees on duty here. The supervisor, a middle-aged man of Indian descent who took his job seriously, was already figuring out something was wrong when Pekaski and the others arrived. A general alert to anyone else in the building could not be prevented, and Pekaski was forcing himself not to count seconds before someone decided to take action. His growing nervousness was not helped when Fujimura put into motion the next phase of her attack on the plant's infrastructure by disabling computer access and main power throughout most of the complex, with the notable exception of the control room along with the plant's primary power source and the outgoing distribution network. That action carried with it the risk of being detected from somewhere beyond the plant itself, a reality that only heightened Pekaski's anxiety. He consulted his wrist chronometer.
In truth, almost 10 minutes had elapsed since their taking of the plant's control room. How had their presence gone undetected for such a stretch of time? Were Fujimura's efforts to hide their activities that effective, or was their good fortune a product of simple luck? Pekaski had no desire to learn the answer to that question.
"Izayo," he prompted.
"Working on it."
Her tone was one of mild irritation, and Pekaski let her have it. Fujimura was a former civilian employee of the city's security forces, and her habit was to become hyper-focused on the task right in front of her, almost to the exclusion of all other stimuli. Distractions only served to stoke her annoyance, and she had no qualms about making her displeasure known, regardless of the recipient of her ire. Supervisors and watch commanders had long ago quit bothering to counsel her on her behavior, as they learned her greatest value lay in her technical acumen rather than people skills. Of course, none of her work or eccentricities would matter if Fujimura was unable to execute the results of that labor, or if the plant's other employees were able to stage an organized defense of the building, or if they received help from the Starfleet crew, of which Pekaski knew two were somewhere in the building. They were an unexpected crimp in his overall plan, but they could be handled, provided no reinforcements were summoned. As part of her preparations, Fujimura had anticipated this possibility and brought with her the equipment necessary to jam communications to and from the plant. With the exception of their own communications devices, all of which were locked on a specific frequency, all other channels were inaccessible. This included the communicators carried by Starfleet personnel.
"Hey, somebody's coming!"
Pekaski heard the warning from one of his men mere heartbeats before phaser fire erupted from somewhere outside the control room. The man guarding the door closest to that action flinched, trying to press himself against the wall while aiming his weapon into the passageway and returning fire. Recognizing the distinctive high pitch of the weapons being fired from the corridor, Pekaski knew the identity of their new adversaries.
"Starfleet." "Izayo!"
he shouted, as he moved to help the man holding position at the door.
"Damn it, they're here!"
Fujimura turned in her seat.
"I'm in. I've circumvented all the safety protocols, and we can initiate the sequence whenever you're ready."
"Do it!"
snapped Pekaski. Moving closer to the door, he fired 3 times into the corridor, shooting more to provide cover than with any real hope of finding actual targets. He thought he caught sight of at least 2 figures lurking in the shadows of the dimly lit passageway, but he could not be sure. Glancing behind him, he shouted,
"Now, Izayo!"
Nodding, Fujimura flashed a knowing smile before turning back to the workstation. Once more, her fingers moved across both the keypad of her portable computer terminal and the rows of buttons on the console as she entered yet another sequence of instructions. Then, she leaned back in her seat, the index finger of her right hand poised with dramatic flair over a blinking red button.
"Time to wake the neighbors."
She pressed the button, and only then did Pekaski realize he was holding his breath and clenching his jaw. Then he saw one of the figures moving in the hallway again and fired in its direction. His effort resulted in another miss.
"Come on, Izayo, come on!"
Looking to where Fujimura remained at her station, Pekaski saw several indicators on the control room's main status board had flipped from green to red. An alarm began sounding from a recessed speaker in the ceiling, which Fujimura disabled by touching another control. From his vantage point, Pekaski could make out the status board's display screens, each of which was scrolling lines of text generated by the plant's automated oversight system. The monitors were all providing him with small portions of a larger, multifaceted story that he was eager to see.
"Power surge is at 184% of normal energy flow," reported Fujimura. "Just as I expected. No safety protocols are kicking in. That should be more than enough."
"Hey, somebody's coming."
"Damn it."
Hearing the shout of alarm, Inamori Jen wondered what she had done to give away her presence to the man standing watch, a mere 10 meters in front of her, just inside the east door leading to the power plant's control room. Not that it was important anymore. What mattered was that the pale man with red hair and brandishing a security forces phaser had seen her.
Further, his reactions were in keeping with someone who was the recipient of extensive law enforcement or military weapons training, which is to say that without hesitation, he took aim and fired at her. Jen felt a hand on her arm an instant before she was yanked to her left. The intervention was fortunate, in that it removed her from the line of fire just as a bright red energy beam sliced through the space she had occupied a second earlier. It was Sultani pulling her to the other side of the corridor, which was afforded small measure of concealment thanks to the orientation of the control room door and the position of the guard just inside it. Without a direct line of sight to his quarry, the guard was forced to shift his position in the hopes of getting a better shot. Sultani was not about to give him that, and instead fired his own phaser three times, then twice more in the direction of the door. The man inside ducked away from the entrance.
Watch out!
Vanessa Chandra's warning gave Sultani time to move aside just before more phaser fire emerged from the control room. Emergency battery-powered lighting provided the only illumination in the corridor, and the resulting shadows served as meager concealment. So long as their opponents stayed within the well-lit control room, it would be harder for them to see who was shooting at them.
What do we do?
Asked Jen.
Chandra replied, They have access to the entire plant from that room. I have no idea what they want, but if it's in there, then it can't be good.
Then everything went dark. Again. Unlike the power loss that had plunged most of the plant into near darkness, this time a massive metallic snapping sound accompanied the outage. Ahead of her, she saw the control room fall victim to this latest failure.
Oh, shit, said Chandra. I think they just took the entire plant offline.
Sultani asked, Do you have backup generators?
For the offices and workspaces, sure, replied the plant supervisor. But the distribution network itself is down. All the power requirements for the city are being handled by the other two plants until this one can be brought back online, and that doesn't happen automatically. There are diagnostics to be run, switches and relays to be reset, and a few other checks before we can bring it all back up. The whole process takes over an hour, and that's assuming whoever did this didn't destroy everything we need to do that.
We didn't.
The voice echoed in the corridor, followed by the three of them being bathed in the bright beam of a flashlight. Then, phaser fire lanced forward from the direction of the control room, catching Chandra in the chest. She sagged against Sultani, who barely managed to keep her from falling face first to the corridor floor. Jen turned toward the control room, bringing up her phaser.
Don't even think about it!
The warning came with another energy beam that tore into the wall to her left, slicing through the metal. Jen froze as the male voice that had given the command instructed,
Drop your weapons!
Both Sultani and Jen did as they were told, holding up empty hands. Next to her, she heard Sultani trying to hold Chandra's limp form. Glancing in his direction, she saw him lowering her body to the floor.
Ina, he said, his tone low and anxious. Chandra's dead.
There was no chance to process this latest unsettling news before Jen heard footsteps and the beam's source began drawing closer. She could not see who was holding the flashlight, but she could sense at least three sets of thoughts.
What do we do with them? Asked another voice.
Jen heard a metallic click before the man who gave the initial orders and perhaps killed Vanessa Chandra spoke again.
Take them with us.
28. Darkness swallowed the passageway around Giorgio as the lights went out. Sparks swiped at the blackness around her as circuits overloaded and lighting fixtures exploded, triggering alarms in the corridor. No sooner did the primary illumination disappear than it was replaced by emergency lamps positioned at regular intervals along the passageway. She was also aware of the omnipresent thrum of the Narbonne's internal generators fading. Even the airflow from the ship's environmental control processes ceased, making more prominent the sounds of clicks and beeps as battery-operated backup systems activated.
What the hell just happened?
A dull hum was beginning to emanate through the deck plating, and as she leaned against a bulkhead, Giorgio felt a mild reverberation in its metal surface. To her left and right, members of the ship's crew were stumbling into the passageway through half-open doorways, the ones they had been able to pry apart at least.
"Commander Georgiou," said a voice, and she saw Lieutenant Melissa Parham making her way up the corridor toward her. "Are you all right?"
Georgiou nodded.